This is a Collider.com audio interview.
All right, guys, thanks for watching that twice. Thanks to Sony, that's how it will play in theaters. Twice. It's expensive, but I think it'll work. Should we just take questions?
Is that how? Just raise your hand and I'll just call on you and we'll go from there.
None.
Right there.
What's the storyline with the characters?
What's the storyline with the characters? To explain it, I guess, briefly, I'm an irresponsible kind of idiot, as one might imagine. And my father dies, and I kind of form a friendship with someone else who did not have the highest feelings towards him, one of his employees, Cato, and through that friendship, we both realize that, maybe we can create this kind of thing that will help us both live out our dreams, what we've always wanted to do, and at the same time, we realize that each other's personalities are kind of the most difficult thing to overcome in trying to form this thing, and that's kind of where the story goes.
And we, there is a relationship with the father, even though the father dies pretty soon in the story, we see a bit of the Brett Reed's childhood and how his father sort of wounded him without willing. And this relationship gets to find its resolution through your inner voice.
Yeah.
He's talking to his dad through in his mind.
In terms of the action stuff that we saw, it looks like you guys have worked even more on sort of your approach to how the Cato fights and things like that are working. Is this more of the final look of Cato Vision, or is it still evolving? Are you guys still finding it?
No, it's not really represented here. I mean, there is the outside of Cato Vision, but there is not his point of view.
Oh, okay.
So that's going to be more like a surprise, I guess.
Yeah.
He has a way to see things.
Yeah, you see, there's kind of two steps to Cato Vision, as I guess we've called it. There's kind of the way you see the fights as the observer, and there's the way Cato kind of perceives the fights in his own eyes. Yeah.
Jeremy?
So, in following up on that, have you kind of reconsidered how you're staging those fights with now that you're doing it in 3D?
Well, to be honest, we always were hoping to go 3D. So the way I put the camera in the scene, the way I conceived the effect, was always like, we were thinking, oh, it would be so cool to do it in 3D. So we didn't really change the way we conceived the fight, but we said we pushed a little bit more some of the effect because we thought, oh, in 3D it's going to be even better. So we pushed it a little bit. But the way the fight works, I mean, for instance, there is something when we use split screen, and we're going to use the depth of the 3D to establish, to split the screen on different levels. I mean, one close, one far, and sometimes it's more complex than that. But on this level, we added some effect, but overall, we sort of always wanted to do it in 3D.
Obviously, with the first trailers, the first time that audiences are going to see your movie, how involved were the four of you in deciding, you know, did you have other versions of this trailer? How involved were you in deciding how the trailer was going to go?
Yeah, there's been a lot of versions of it, and we're pretty involved, you know. We watch it every step of the way. We have to acknowledge, honestly, that, like, our perceptions of the movie are different than sometimes your general person who knows absolutely nothing about the Green Hornet's perceptions of the movie. I mean, I'm sure even the people in this room know around a million times more about the Green Hornet than 99% of the people who will be seeing this trailer. So, honestly, I mean, some of you came to set and saw another thing, and that was, you know, that was kind of the version of, if you kind of know what the Green Hornet is, here's an introduction to it. But we really had to keep reminding ourselves that we were approaching it from the place of people who've literally never heard the words Green Hornet together in a sentence before. And we were very involved in that and really wanted to make sure that it kind of portrayed the feel of the movie more than anything, you know?
Since this was the first piece that was going to come out on the Green Hornet, we really showed it a lot and got a lot of feedback and tested the trailer quite a few times to make sure that what we liked about it, it was the thing that the audience was going to like about it the most as well.
And we really wanted to make sure our enthusiasm for the character and the story would be conveyed. And I think in our approach and in collaboration to the people who work on the trailer, with a different team, of course, we really worked close on... I mean, in the past, I had worked in a company to make my trailer, and it's not necessarily always as enjoyable as it happened on this one. A lot of times, conflict and conflict of interest, but in this time, I really... And even I saw the poster, and I was saying to Seth, it's the first time I really have a poster for a movie I've done that I'm excited about.
We really... I mean, the gold of this movie is the relationship between Britt and Cato, and you get a little bit of it in this trailer, but in the subsequent trailer, that's what really we'll be concentrating on
yeah.
as well.
And we knew we just honestly had to just introduce the idea of the Green Hornet to people first, and then knowing there'll be more trailers and more advertising down the line, we can kind of explore the intricacies of what the movie's about. But first you just have to, you know, make sure people understand the general concept of what it is that you're doing, you know.
Jen?
Hi. I actually was one of the people on the set visit last year, and one of the aspects that you guys were playing up at that time was the idea that sort of Cato is really more the superhero, and Green Hornet is sort of a work in progress, really. As the film kind of takes its final form, is that still an aspect that's going to kind of remain, or is that kind of going by the, by the side, or...
I mean, Cato is definitely the more skilled individual involved. You know, we joke about with Seth, and
come on,
you know, he had to get in shape to do the movie, and so
Jay didn't. He was in shape.
It's inherently there, but yeah. No, yeah, he's a very, very talented kind of genius type of guy, and Seth's character is just a normal guy.
But that being said, you know, we didn't want the joke to be, look at this, you know, completely unequipped, you know, we didn't want the joke to be one of complete and utter goofiness and physical incompetence at all times. And we knew that ultimately it has to live up to the expectations of a superhero movie, and needs to have the kind of action, the kind of full-blown action that people expect from that genre. And we knew we couldn't just rest on comedy in order to make it interesting, that it also had to be exciting, you know?
Because in a certain way, the Black Beauty is the superhero of the movie, something that they create together.
Yeah.
Don?
Kind of follow up on that. What, as you're editing the movie, what kind of tone are you going for, and what kind of tone do you see emerging in terms of balancing the action and the comedy? This is clearly not the sort of dark superhero film we've seen in a few different franchises.
Well, I think this... Stakes, that's the word you use,
yes.
are pretty high, and there is comedy, but I think overall the tone is, it's absolutely not a spoof. I mean, I think you get the idea from the trailer. So we never intended to do something like comical about the comment on the genre. We really embrace the superhero film genre. And it's pretty, I mean, there is serious part, and of course there is some comedy, but I think it's overall it's more an action movie.
We always talked about it as an action movie with comedy versus a comedy with yeah. action.
But Michelle and Sally Menke, our editor, are really coming up with a lot of really interesting ways to tell the story, you know, I mean... you know, both of them are really great at that. Gondry obviously did Eternal Sunshine. She edited, you know, Pulp Fiction and movies like that, which really are great at kind of playing with the narrative and the storytelling. And it's really amazing to see what they've done in the editing room, and how what a giant creative step the movie's taken. You know, leaving the movie in Michelle and Sally's hands for a little while, and it's exciting for us just as fans, you know, to see your movie filmed and then taken to this whole other place, you know.
There in the front.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, like, how close the storyline fits into the comic, the Green Hornet comic. Because I was thinking he was a bad guy when I had originally heard the premise.
The Green Hornet comic has nothing to do with our movie.
Oh, really?
Other than it's called The Green Hornet.
Oh.
But Yeah, sorry. unless you love it, then it's exactly based on.
You took a lot of elements from.
Yeah, I mean, we both took elements. I know. I think Kevin Smith, Matt Wagner's writing some of the comics also. I mean, I've read some of them. I mean, we clearly all got our ideas from the same source material. There's some elements that are the same, and I think naturally, when trying to update something, some of the ideas are going to go to similar places. But there was no collaboration on behalf of the comic and the filmmakers.
The one constant is that he poses as a criminal to catch criminals.
I think what's important to say is like the Green Hornet has so many forms. I mean, it started with a radio show, then he was a comic for a few issues. Then he was back. He was on TV, and then in the 60s it was on TV in the 40s.
There's movie serials also.
And then you have Bruce Lee, who has brought a tremendous weight on the attention to it. So we have to sort of digest all that to find what would be our version of the Green Hornet. And as a director, I was thinking to make a movie before I would make a comic book movie. And I think that's why I was asked to direct this film. And as well, the notion of Kato has evolved so much over the years, because he was called Kato, he was supposed to be Japanese initially, and then during World War II, because of the war with Japan, they had to change his character, so he was not Japanese anymore. He was Filipino first, and then he became Chinese. So all that is part of the sort of the legacy, and we sort of we respect that, but we have to bring it to a place that would fit now.
The 3D conversion process has gotten some criticisms lately with like Clash of the Titans and Alice in Wonderland. Can you talk about what measures maybe you're taking to avoid some of those pitfalls or help this look better?
That's why we moved our release date back, is because we wanted our 3D to look really, really good. And the only way we could do that was by buying ourselves more time to make it good. And we already have sequences that we've turned over now going to 3D. So we have plenty of time to actually make it good and do it the right way versus, Clash of Titans was what, done in 6-8 weeks total.
And it's honestly, it's like any other visual effect. There's really good applications of it and really bad applications. I mean, it's literally a visual effect, and it's all depends on who whose hands it's in, I think. I think you look at CG sometimes and it looks terrible. You look at CG sometimes and it looks great, and I think it's no different. There's very good versions of it, there's very bad versions of it, and I think it's like any other creative decision is going to be gauged by the abilities and enthusiasm of the creative people behind it, and it's something that we all feel really strongly about. Like Michelle said, it's something that we've always wanted since the first idea to do this movie came along. I mean, I've been working in 3D movies for years. I started doing Monsters vs. Aliens almost 4 or 5 years ago, I think, and it was then I literally traveled around the world with Jeffrey Katzenberg, hearing him pontificate on 3D and what a big evolution it was going to be. So it's always been something that I've been a big fan of. Michel Gondry's grandfather was part of a stereoscopic society in the 60s, I believe. So it's something we've always been big supporters of, and I think, just like I said, there's good versions and there's bad versions. We hope to do a really good version.
The way the film was shot, coming back to that,
yeah.
I mean, you could imagine, if you take a movie in 2D and you transform it in 3D, you could imagine different films. But if you take a movie like, for instance, Citizen Kane, where, and of course, I'm not saying I'm Orson Welles or anything like that, but if you take this type of movie where they really use, and actually was one of the first time they used the full depth of field, the third dimension, this movie, if it was transformed into 3D, into stereo, would work much better than a lot of other films which are, for instance, using much more fast editing and a long lens to give sort of all those close-ups that you always want in movies. But we didn't shoot it really this way. And even when before we thought we could do it in 3D, we talk about the fight and we say, okay, for instance, we like the Bond identity very much, but we don't want to rely too much on the editing too much to make the fight stronger. So we want to have a fight that's strong to start with. So we didn't make it so fast with editing, and this is a very important element to make a 3D work well.
It wasn't a rash decision by any means. We saw a lot of demonstrations and met with a lot of different companies, and then ultimately brought a number of these companies into the editing room, went through the film with them together, and really went through what could be the pitfalls, the positives of doing it, the negatives to do it, and kind of weighed those all out before we even approached the studio and asked them to let us turn it into 3D, which is obviously, there's a huge financial impact to that as well. And it wasn't until, I mean, I remember Amy Pascal said to us, she said, you know, this is going to cost us a lot of extra money. Are you guys sure about this? And we were, because we had done so much homework on it. We just were very, we did not want to be, you know, reprimanded like Clash of the Titans or some of these other movies that are being rushed out so quick. We really wanted to take our time and do it right.
Yeah, and we knew everyone would hate the idea of it. I mean, we're not idiots. We know the first thing that people like you say is that the studio is forcing us to do it and that it's a quick fix. And what's funny is it literally could not have been more opposite. It was us begging and pleading as creative entities for them to allow us to have this tool to tell our story in a more interesting and original way. And we're super excited that we're able
there
to do
it. There are some effects, as I was describing before, that totally clipped with the idea of 3D, and as well some idea, because there is, as I was saying, the relationship with the father evolved even after he's passed away, and Seth Breitred keep talking to him in his mind, I mean, not all the time, but several times. So we got this idea to represent his father,
Tom Wilkinson.
Yeah.
Tom Wilkinson, by his silhouette that you can only see if you watch a movie in 3D. So if you watch a movie without the glasses or in 2D, then you would hear the voice because it's like a voiceover. But when you put the glasses, it's like this magic poster, it's going to pop out. So that's an idea we were so thrilled to be able to execute with the 3D, and it was a happy coincidence in a way, because we always had this voiceover of the father coming in the story, but then when we decided to do it in 3D, then it was perfect.
Jeremy?
At some point in the marketing of this film, do you think that are you going to try to invoke the Bruce Lee thing? I mean, it seems like it's obviously some kind of a selling point, but it's also, could be a bit of a third rail, I don't know.
It seems, I mean, honestly, I bet if you ask most high school kids who Bruce Lee is, they won't. They'll say the guy sitting next to an English class. I think, I don't think that it would, I think it's not something that would ever be my instinct to do, and I think it's something I would probably implore people not to attempt. Honestly, Jay Chou is like one of the coolest dudes I've ever met or been around in my life. He's like Steve McQueen, we always say. He's just he does everything cooler than anyone else does anything. And I think Jay himself, I mean, every day I was like, man, I've never been psyched to show up to work every day and be completely overshadowed by somebody on a daily basis. And it's just how it is. And I think that Jay, in his own right, will win people over. And he's an incredibly impressive, charismatic performer and an incredibly talented martial artist. And he's just a rad dude. So I think that I don't think we'll need to do that, and
I don't think anybody here ever thinks that, you know, we will replace or are trying to be better than what Bruce Lee was. I mean,
we didn't try to. We kind of went with a new. Just as different as I am from Van Williams, Jay is from Bruce Lee. You know, I mean, we wanted to create new characters in the telling of the story.
By respect, mostly. I mean, of course, for any actor from Asia, it's a terrible, it's very heavy sort of tech to take over on Bruce Lee. But like, for instance, Jay never want to emulate Bruce Lee by any means. And he didn't want to do this type of expression, this type of like sound or scream. So by out of respect, we really didn't want to mimic him.
Yeah, he definitely was very conscious of not doing a Bruce Lee impression. He wanted to make his own character. You know, he was really, he was into that, and thank God he did, because he makes a great Kato.
Jeannie?
Since the character is clearly lesser known than, say, Superman, Spider-Man, Batman, some of the other superhero movies, Is there any concern going into that, and what sort of marketing or other things might be done to sort of address that and make it more publicly, bring the Green Hornet more publicly aware as the movie comes out?
That's why you're all here.
Exactly. But I think it's also, I mean, for whoever saw the first trailer versus this one, I mean, I think that line of thought is exactly what led us to realizing this is the approach we needed to take, because... You know, like we looked, I remember when Iron Man came out, me and my girlfriend were driving by a billboard, she said, "What's Iron Man?" And they did a good job at taking, I mean, Iron Man, believe it or not, it's hard to believe now, was a relatively unknown Marvel character when that first movie came out, and they did a good job at introducing it. They didn't really tease it, there was no real teaser, they just kind of showed you exactly what it was, and that's something that we talked about. You know, they successfully took a pretty obscure character and made him very well known and introduced him to people, and that's kind of what we realized we had to do, was not show, hey, here's our version of the Green Hornet, we just have to show first, like, here's what the fuck the Green Hornet is, you know?
It's a PG-13 movie.
The only fuck I've said this whole time, that's not bad.
Oh. Steve.
Steve.
You guys are about a month away from Comic-Con, so have you already started having that conversation of, are you guys going to be there, and or what might you be showing the fans at Comic-Con?
We will definitely be there with a big presence, and we have a terrific piece that we will be showing.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to show it in 3D, right?
If it's done in time and done to the quality we want it to be, you will see the 3D at that time.
Yeah.
Or a piece of it, I should say.
The whole movie. But yeah, we've already been looking at stuff to show. I mean, we're all Comic-Con fans. I love Comic-Con, so as just comic book nerds, it's important to us to show the respect to those people who go out and schlep their asses over there to watch.
We have the ultimate trailer. We're going to tease that. We're going to show the entire movie backwards.
Exactly. The whole movie with voiceover of the teaser guy.
One of the reasons a lot of people are excited is because the whole idea of like bringing your like unique visual style, like the Michel Gondry like look, to a comic book action movie is like so appealing. But I didn't really see a lot of it in the trailer. Is there more? Is that something you minimized for the trailer?
Yeah, there is more, but I mean, I don't want really to. There is a danger of like having a shtick. You know, if like I need to put my stamp on everything, I think definitively you would see it in a movie, but it's not going to alienate the film from being experienced like a traditional movie. But there is some sequence that we are still working on, for example, we could not integrate in the trailer that more have more my specific signature. But when we met, they said, "Oh, we want to do a big dream sequence." And I said, "No, no, stop! I don't want to do it."
Originally, I was going to be made of string.
Seth, you talk about as a comic book collector. Is this the first time you're getting an action figure that's actually you?
I think it might be. I had a Bob. That's not really an action figure, though. Kind of a blue toy. But, yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm excited. It's my instinct to blow it up with firecrackers, though. I might do that.
Anyone else? Right here, Phil?
Yeah. I think a lot of people are, more than, like, people saying, oh, this is the Green Hornet movie, people are saying, like, this is, like, the Seth Rogen action movie. I was wondering what, and you've slimmed down and stuff, so I'm wondering what people, what is your approach to getting people over that hump of, like, Seth Rogen as action hero?
Well, as you can see, I mean, my guy's not exactly, like, you know, Bruce Wayne. I mean, the whole story of the movie is that I'm an irresponsible idiot who's trying to get his life together and do something worthwhile, so... I think as an irresponsible idiot, I'm quite good, and I think it's an easy buy. So I think that, I mean, honestly, for years we didn't want to just tell people what the whole story of the movie was, but that's why we always knew it was going to be fine, because the story wasn't that of a completely serious, well-groomed, well-mannered man who decides to become a superhero. It's about a guy who's grappling with his own irresponsible activities and tendencies, and can he put those aside and do something worthwhile? So that's why, as an actor, I thought it was something that I could tackle, because it displayed what people expect from me and what maybe I could show as a growth throughout the character, you know?
Well, but I need to nuance it a bit what you're saying.
Okay.
I think what I was hoping when I took the job, basically, is that, okay, we have somebody who has been very successful in one area, and I try, but my contribution could help that, which, in a way, it was successful. I was successful in doing that, I think, with Jim Carrey, where he was mostly known. I mean, he had done Truman Show, which was amazing too. And he was known as being a comedian, and I think he was excellent as being much more dramatic in Eternal Sunshine. So I think Seth sort of sell himself short a little bit, because I think he really embodied a very complex and really interesting character. And my hope is that people will see him evolve, becoming like, for instance, you know, of course, everybody always project himself doing that. Like, for instance, Tom Hanks, who started with comedy, and then, I mean, there is another actor who started specifically in comedy, and then because they had the death.
Wesley Snipes.
but I think, but Sally Mackey, who did all the movies that Tarantino directed, it literally fell in love with Seth. I think you have to address the problem.
Exactly. But no, I mean, it's true. I mean, but what he's saying is right. I mean, in part of the reason we first decided to even approach Michelle was we knew that it was going to be something different and a step in a different direction, and he was traditionally someone that was great at taking people who were known as comedic actors and bringing them into a new direction, and he had done that very well. And taking people who are known as serious actors and making them much funnier than you had seen them be before, like Kate Winslet in Eternal Sunshine, and I think that's something that was really one of his strengths and something that we really hoped he would bring to this, you know?
Among you was really the champion that said, dear friends at Sony, we need to make the Green Hornet movie?
It's a good question.
We were all champions at different times.
I mean, yeah, we've all been champions at different times. I mean, it's one of those things, where does an idea come from? I'm sure the movie Inception will answer that for us. But I think, you know, it's one of those things that it's hard. I mean, it's hard to think of where the notion. I mean, Gamgee was attached to a Green Hornet movie 13 years ago, literally. So it's hard to say who was the first one that wanted to do it. I can say we've all. I would say, like, no matter what, they're making a Thor movie. No matter what, they're making a Captain America movie. They're not, no matter what, making a Green Hornet movie. And we had to work really hard to have them let us do this, you know? It wasn't a given. It wasn't a movie that was eventually going to get made no matter what, and we were just the guys lucky enough to do it. We really creatively saw this as an opportunity that was exciting to us, and we've all fought really hard, a lot of uphill battles, a lot of bad press, a lot of strikes against us, and hasn't been easy, but ultimately we're really proud of it. We all love the movie, and I'm excited to be able to show you something. I was just saying to Evan while we were walking here, today's the first day I actually believe this movie might get released, which is exciting.
I've never been involved in a movie where we had so many start-stops, and I think it was August of last year, and I think Amy Pascal and a number of the other people were on vacation, and I think that was the reason we actually got to finally go ahead. But it's been a great experience, and, you know, I hope
what
everybody likes the movie.
Did you not understand?
But yeah, it's, I mean, but it, honestly, it's something we all strongly agree, we're passionate about. It's something, it's an idea for some reason, the relationship between these two guys, honestly, the idea of exploring that relationship, I mean, as creators, me and Evan are writing partners, Michelle as a director constantly is teaming up with people, like, you know, and you create these relationships and you try to make something out of it, and it's something that we all just felt very strongly about, and again, was not a movie that was going to get made no matter what. It's something that we had to will into being, and it's something that we had to work to make happen, you know. If we didn't do it, there would not be a Green Hornet movie on the screen right now.
Steve? Seth, I'm curious, you're known for improv. On this film, was there a lot of that, or was it, could you talk a little bit about how it was on set?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely wanted it to at times, you know, when the relationships have that spontaneous feel, you know, I just think that we, me and Evan, have just found that that's what works really well with our movies, just the things that I think people relate to a lot are the ways the characters interact, and I think they see themselves and their own friends' interactions in those movies, hopefully, and a lot of that is through improv, and Jay is amazing at it, and even in that thing when he goes, I'll go with you, but I don't want to touch you, he improvised that. That was totally something he just said while we were joking around one day in a scene, and yeah, so there was a lot, and everyone got really into it, Christoph, but you know, obviously with an action movie, there's kind of limitations at times to what you can do, but I think the movie has kind of it doesn't have a rigid feel to it by any means. I think it has a very loose conversational feel, would you say?
Yeah, well, I think always my interest in making movies and even some videos was to have something really technical and sort of achieved and sort of performance, but mixed with something that seems not so formal. It seems very fluid and I mean, kind of sound pretentious right now.
It's the accent.
But I realized very soon that it's not because there are constraints, like technical constraints, like if there is a lot of in-camera effect or trick or explosion, that the performance has to be stiff. That's actually the opposite. A lot of time the actor sort of get their mind free because there is so much happening that they don't think too much of what it is that they have to do to act or to be serious or to be funny. They just are more themselves. So this context is actually a very good way to get great performance and including improvisation.
You have time for one or two more, so Don?
Can you guys talk about working with Christoph on this and maybe what, coming from his background, which is in European cinema, what he brings to that sort of archetypal comic book villain role?
Working with him was great. I would say that his character is a very unique villain, I hope. Not something we're going to talk about a lot because I think it's something that people are excited to kind of discover on their own. But Christoph is a great actor. He's really fun. He embraced coming and doing things in our very strange way with open arms. And I don't know. He's a technically very impressive actor to watch, and he has a lot of weight, and he's very intimidating at times. But at the same time, he's really nice and collaborative. And I would love to work with him many more times.
Have you guys started working on the score yet? And if so, can you talk about the process and what we can expect?
Well, Danny Elfman is writing the score, and we didn't hear anything yet, so it's beginning, it's starting.
But watching him and Michelle weird out together is pretty rad.
Yep.
We'll take Jim's question, that'll be the last one.
Talked a little bit about working with Cameron Diaz and sort of how much did she get involved in the action of the film?
Nicest lady in the whole world.
Yeah, I guess as to how much she gets involved in the action, we probably should keep that somewhat under wraps for drama's sake. But she's amazing, and she's gets very involved in creatively, you know. The character, it was really important to us that it wasn't just kind of an obligatory character and that it really added a lot to the movie, both comedically and story-wise, and she had a lot of great ideas, and really, it's anytime like someone that famous puts any extra effort into anything, I'm really blown away by it, because I just know I won't if I ever get that famous, and I remember Evan literally had a party one night, and like she showed up while Evan was totally drunk, and like gave him like 2 hours worth of notes, and just like made Evan like drunkenly type them on his computer, and I thought like, wow, that's so impressive. And it was
she came in maybe 10 times to help Jay Cho learn English.
Yeah, I mean, Jay's English at first was a little sketchy at times, and she put an enormous amount of time and energy into making sure that their scenes were natural and understandable, but very loose and funny. And it was the kind of thing where you're like, she's too fucking famous to be doing this. She should be on her island.
That's it, guys. Thanks so much for
making
it out.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.